Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and recovering alcoholics around the world. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. Tonight's event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery! This sober member does not want or even need an introduction. Within our AA community, she is truly a breath of fresh air. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Visalia, Debbie G.
Wow. Thank you, Mark. Okay. Hello, everybody. My name is Debbie G, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank you, Phil, for asking me to do this. And I'm never one of those people when you go around at meetings and they say, you know, they call on you or something. I never say, oh, no, that's okay. I'll pass. I don't want to talk. So I always talk in meetings. But when I was asked to do this, I said, oh, no. I don't want to. I'm not ready. I'm not good enough. I'm not there yet. I don't want to. And with a lot of encouragement and support from a lot of people, I prayed about it, and I decided that I should do this. And it's not about me. Everything's not about me. And I hated finding that out, but it happened. And, you know, it's always, whenever I come to a speaker meeting, I don't always like the speaker. I don't always like what they say. I sometimes don't like them. And you may feel that way, too, tonight, and that's okay. Because I know when you leave, you'll feel better. And I know when I'm finished, I'll feel better, too. So, thank you so much, everybody that has put up with me in the last few days, because, I don't know, I was trying to take this into my own hands, and I had a pretty tough act to follow, because I don't know if David's here tonight, the speaker that we had last Wednesday, but he did an awesome job, and he seemed so calm. And then we went to the picnic, and we heard that guy, and wow, you know. So I was thinking, oh, man, I really, really got unlucky. But anyway, you know, if I can just have one person tonight hear something that it will help them and give them some hope, then I will have done my job. Because my job today is to be of service to God and to other people. And if one person can get something out of my message, then I will have been in service. So thank you so much. You know, giving back what I've been given is what makes my life worthwhile today. And I think I've come to believe that when I leave this earth, the only things I'm going to take with me are the immaterial things that I have given away. So thank you for listening, and I'll tell you a little bit about like what I was like. I was pretty normal as a kid, and I grew up in a household that, you know, was pretty normal. I mean, if you drove by where we lived, it looked pretty good. Middle class neighborhood, a mom, a dad, a little girl, a little boy, a family pet, nice car. Didn't look too bad, you know. That's how it was on the outside. And on the inside, it didn't feel right. It didn't feel too good. Didn't really look as good as, didn't feel as good as it looked. And my father was an alcoholic, and his father, my mom's dad, my mom's brother, me, my brother, and it never skipped a beat, my family with my kids. I have two daughters that are in the program. I have one daughter that got here before I did, and I'm proud of her, and I think she had a lot to do with me getting here, so I just want to say thank you to my daughter, and to everybody that's here, you know, I don't know. I hope I can do this without bawling. Oh, my God. I'm not a crier. But I do get emotional about my recovery. Like I said, it was pretty normal in my household to have alcohol around. My dad was very sociable. He was one of those people that everybody liked him. He was fun. He was funny. You know, he was a good provider. Things seemed pretty normal with alcohol, you know. And was that way on the in his social world. I think we wear a lot of hats, you know. And I think my dad suffered from kick the dog syndrome, you know, which I have too. I don't always appreciate the people that love me and care about me, you know. And I never knew how he was going to come home at night. I didn't know what his mood was going to be like or what he was going to be thinking or how he was going to act or who he was going to pick to kind of light in on, you know. And I can remember, I don't know if everybody here, some of you are old enough to remember that TV show Rawhide and that music that pounded. I hated that music because that was about the time he would roll in, you know. And my heart would start, I'd get scared, you know. He wasn't nice sometimes. And he treated my mother not very well. And I always thought my mother was weak because she didn't really stand up to him. She just kind of took it, and I made up my mind early in life I wasn't going to let a man treat me like that. And so I did my very best not to turn into my mother. Isn't that what we all fear, that we're going to turn into our mothers? I know Shelley thought that. Yeah. But what happened to me was I turned into my dad. You know, I got just like him, and I had his characteristics of his sarcasm, his criticism, his judgment, and just his intolerance, really, of people when I started drinking, you know. When I grew up, I was pretty normal. I went to school. I got good grades. I didn't cause any trouble. But for me, alcohol was a symptom way before I ever started drinking. It started up here, right here. I remember when I was in second grade, they passed out the report card, and I looked at mine, and I didn't like what it said, and I proceeded to fill in every quarter with all S's. And I kept taking that back to school, and they kept giving it back to me. There were no consequences. I didn't get in trouble for that. You know, and I thought that was kind of weird but I thought I'd really pulled a fast one, you know, back then. And I don't know, I got to junior high, and things were a little different, you know, when you go up to junior high, things change a little bit, you know, at the school, in the school level. And I was really little for my age. I was a little scrawny girl, you know. I was really skinny, short. And I don't know, I always felt less than. You know, I didn't feel like the other girls, you know. there was a majorette tryout, and my mom encouraged me to do that. I guess she wanted to get something back from her well-spent money. And so I tried out, and there were only two seventh graders that tried out, myself and another girl, and the other girls were all eighth graders. And, you know, those girls, to me, they were pretty. You know, they already looked like girls, if you get my drift, you know, and I didn't. I was little. And so I tried out, and I thought, oh, boy, I have no prayer of this. And when I went to school, the day I was supposed to go in and look and see who made it, my name was on there, and I made it. And I ran out, and I told my mom, and she was all excited. And I was pretty excited, too. Until they started passing out the uniforms. And that was something that they did back then. You know, we just used them year over and over and over, and they just alter them. Well, mine had to be taken up way much, you know. And I was okay about all of that until one of the girls said, we knew this was going to happen, because you are so little. And that's why we picked you. We wanted a mascot. And not hurt my feelings. And it sounds like a really small thing, but it made me feel, again, not good enough, you know. I didn't hear anything but little and mascot. It had nothing to do without my baton twirling ability. But, you know, I did it. I made it through the parade and the fair exhibits and all this stuff, and that was okay. And then I was pretty active in sports, and I was another place where it seemed like all the parents would always come and watch. And my mom made a few games, but my dad never showed up, you know. And I always wondered why I was the only one there really without any parent watching, you know. And it felt like I was just in the wrong family, you know. Anyway, I grew up and I got through those 2 years of junior high and high school started, and things do change then. It changed then for me, and the kind of the friends that had been going around with for, I went to one grammar school, one middle school, and one high school. So there was usually the same kids, you know, and when I got to high school, it seemed like everybody kind of went their separate ways. We weren't, like, as close as we used to be, but I found that it was kind of a lonely feeling. But, you know, things were okay, and I was a freshman, and there was a senior boy that liked me. And my parents wouldn't let me go out with him, of course, but I still felt like that was a good thing. You know, I finally felt like, oh, somebody likes me. You know, because my dad never did make me feel like anybody's little girl. He never loved me like I wanted to be loved. He didn't give me any attention. And like I said, very critical. I couldn't do anything to please him. And I always felt like I was in his way, you know. Anyway, with this new attention that I was getting from this boy, I could clearly see after not too long, you know, that he was a senior, and he had different things on his mind. And I wasn't ready for that kind of attention, so he dropped me like a hot potato, I'll tell you. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, that's not very nice, you know, but I met this girl, and she had older sisters, and we went to a party. Probably about a year later, and we ran into some people, and that was the first time I'd been into the party where there wasn't adult supervision, and we didn't do anything wrong, really. It was pretty mellow back then, and but we did take off with these two people, these two guys, and they were really cute. They were on the football team, and I had no idea that someone like that would like me, you know. And We started dating, and to make a long story short, about 1 year and one day after we started dating, we got married. And I was a junior, and he was a senior. And the reason we got married was because I was pregnant. So I had learned from that last boyfriend that I better do something or they won't like you, you know. So I did, and I got caught, and that was how that started. And they told us we could stay in school if we didn't make a spectacle of ourselves. And, you know, back in 1967, that wasn't very cool. And, you know, that was the first time I ever saw my dad cry. And I don't really think he was crying for me. I think he was crying for himself. Because that was really embarrassing to him. And I had proved him right, because in our family, we didn't get the lecture or the talk about finishing school and going to college and having a career and doing anything like that. We got lectured by him to do the right thing, to not get knocked up, and to not have a bunch of kids to hip around, and to not ever not graduate from high school, and to just be scum of the earth. And that's exactly how I felt, you know. And I wonder why that didn't keep me from doing that. I guess I just thought I wouldn't get caught, you know? I don't know. That's, again, with the thinking. So anyway, we got married, stayed in school, and I had a complicated pregnancy, and I did lose that baby. I had a miscarriage, and when that mess was over with, my dad wanted to have marriage annulled, and we said no. And I didn't want to have that marriage annulled. I wanted to stay right where I was because I finally had somebody who didn't care about me, and his family loved me. They didn't have any girls. They only had boys. And, you know, they really made me feel special. And I liked that family. So we stayed married. The odd thing about it was my my husband and my father became friends. And they started hanging out together, kind of. It was really weird, you know. They drank together, and they went fishing together, and they went hunting together, and they did all the guy stuff, you know. And then they went into business together. And they had a small grocery store in Strathmore Market. And that required my husband to go to work early and come home late because of the store hours. And my dad couldn't do any of that because, you know, by about 3 every day, he was drunk. So he kind of came in and out as soon as he played. So Frank was a responsible person. And I stayed home. I had 2 little girls by the time I was 19 years old. And we did have a little house with a white picket fence. And, you know, I was happy doing that. That is what I thought I wanted to do then. You know, it was fun. And there was a little lady that lived next door to me, and she told me one day, she goes, honey, if you don't quit washing those babies every time they get dirty, you're going to wash the skin right off of them. And it was like playing dolls, you know. And I did that for about 4 years, and then I decided that, you know what, I don't know if I like this or not. This is just not all it's cracked up to be here. You know, my life consists of laundry, grocery shopping, cooking, cleaning, diapers. That's not what I signed up here for. And, of course, the husband wasn't giving me as much attention as I wanted or that I deserved. And I just decided that, you know what, I need to get myself a job. I need to get doing something that's going to make me feel better about myself. So I signed up for beauty school, and I went to beauty school and became a hairdresser. And while there, I had a friend that I thought a lot of, and I kind of admired her. She was another one of those people that I kind of looked up to. I kind of wanted to be like her, you know. And she did an amazing thing that just really appalled me, honestly. And she told us that she wasn't going to go to dinner with us one night when we had gone off to attend a hair show because she was meeting her boyfriend. And I thought that was horrid. I thought it was a horrible thing to do. And we came back home, and in about 30 days, I had an affair going. I got one for myself, you know. I thought it looked okay what she was doing because she could justify why she did that. And, you know, that was a huge mistake. But I do believe that it happened for a reason, and, you know, I wouldn't change it. I'm not proud of it, but it's part of my story. And, you know, I really didn't think there was anything wrong with it, to be honest with you. Still, I'm not drinking. I'm just messed up. You know, I'm selfish. And I want what I want when I want it. And, you know, he paid a lot of attention to me, this man. And he was 34 and I was 24. And I thought, wow, you know what? This could work. This could probably be the ticket here for me out of here because he works 8 to 5. He wears a suit and tie to work. He looks really good in his softball uniform. And he goes to church. He's a nice Christian man. Well, you know, I never, ever once did I think that maybe a nice Christian man wouldn't have to go home and tell his wife and kids he's a prisoner for another woman. But that's exactly what happened. And so that family broke up, my family broke up, and we got married. And, you know, I was hell-bent to marry him because people were trying to convince me to not do this, and I wouldn't listen, and they told me, you know what, he's done this before, you're not the first one. But I was going to be the last, you know, because I could be the last. Well, let me tell you something. Dr. Phil has a saying, and it's, if they'll do it with you, they'll do it to you. And he did. And he started messing around, and I busted him for that. And the funny thing about it was that I was glad, because I was already planning my escape out of there. I did not like that man. I hated him after 6 months. He was boring. He was too churchy. He wouldn't drink, you know, he was just like a prissy man. I don't know. I can't explain it. But, you know, by then we were living in Visalia, and I was working, and I was a hairdresser, and it was a sociable job. It was a really fun job, and we had, every day at the shop, we'd start serving wine, and there were activities that went on with that, and plus, we were still playing the softball thing, and, you know, softball, I don't know, to me, that was just an excuse to drink, too, you know, but I always had to watch myself, and I'm one of those drinkers that if I have to control it, I don't enjoy it. But I was doing a lot of controlled drinking back then, and I was getting pissed off at him so bad that I just couldn't wait to get away from him. And I think that's where it started, you know, that social drinking that we start doing, and we have a little bit of fun, and we notice that maybe I'm enjoying this a little bit too much, more than I should be, but anyway, we got divorced, and I took the money, and I opened up the beauty shop. And that's when it all kind of started for me. My girls were about 8 and 9 then. And, you know, I worked hard. That's when my workaholic stuff started. Because not only am I an alcoholic, I'm a workaholic. And I mixed in with that a manaholic phase. Now, when you combine a manaholic with an alcoholic, there's no room for kids. There is no room for children. They got in my way. They slowed me down. They got on my last nerve. They were pretty good kids still then. And I left them alone too early, you know, way too young. And I didn't need to pay much attention to them, you know. I loved them, and I would tell them I loved them. But truly, I love you, now get out of here was more my attitude, you know. And I didn't get the maternal gene. I don't think my mom had it. I was a terrible mother. I was bad influence, and I was a negative influence, and what's the other word? Example. I didn't do well as a mama. But I had no choice, really. You know, my girls, the father they had, he, sorry to say for them, but they reaped the benefits of what I did to him. You know, he did not like me. He's the only person on my amends list that will not let me make an amends to him. And I tried twice. And he wouldn't do it. And so I wrote it out, you know, and that's okay. It's really his loss because it wasn't about me. It was about what he did to his kids. And, you know, I think that causes little girls, especially, I think they need daddy. If you're men in here and you have little girls, try to be a father to them. We don't all get the earthly fathers we deserve. Anyway, I was leaving my kids a lot, and I was enjoying going out, and I was partying, and I had a couple of younger girls that were working for me, and, you know, we'd go out dancing and drinking and whatnot, and it was just a crazy, crazy time, and during that time, one of the girls that worked for me introduced me to some friend of her boyfriend, and he was wild and crazy. That's the kind I like. I like wild, I like crazy, I like bad, I like, but I want you to have a job and a car and a house. You know, I don't think that's a bad combination. Works for me. But anyway, I met this guy and he was pretty crazy and everybody used to say, you know what? You are just like him. You are a woman sark. And I went, oh, I don't know if I like that description, but that was okay. And you know what? He loved my kids and he called them the queens. And he hadn't had any kids. And his family absolutely adored all of us, you know, and they were pretty well off. And he'd been married before. So when we decided to get married, I had no idea that they would want to have this big old wedding. You know, I mean, my parents were weddinged out. You know, that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know, because I didn't even want them to know I'd been married twice. I mean, obviously they saw I was married once because my kids. But that second time could just be a secret. And it all came to fruition, and they found out everything. And you know what? They love me anyway. And we got baptized in that church. We had a big old church wedding. We had a band. We had a dinner. We had the whole nine yards. I mean, it was like, I even got to have a wedding dress that time. Woohoo! Which I proceeded to swing around the poles at the church afterwards and rip the armpits out of because I was so drunk and loaded on cocaine. And I was a lady. You know, and that one didn't last very long either. That one lasted about that one lasted about 2 years. I came home one night, one day. Now by now I'm doing hair and I got a job. One of my clients said, you need to go and you need to apply at Bonds Market and get a job over there being a checker because you'll get some benefits and you'll have some insurance. Because I had nothing. I mean, I worked my butt off and I made good money, but you don't work, you don't get paid doing hair. So I did that. You know, I was working two jobs and things were rolling along pretty good, you know. Our house was full of fun. You know, it was parties almost every night of the week pretty much. And then on the weekends, lookout, softball tournaments, whatever happened, you know. But all the people that we had around with had kids. So it seemed okay to me. Finally, I didn't have to leave them alone. They could come. They could be part of. And I used to think it was funny because they'd always come up and they'd go, can we have another soda? And I'd go, no, you already had one. Because I was getting out my 20th beer, you know. They can only have one soda. But crazy thinking. Anyway, I came home one night after work and he said he quit his job. And I said, well, oh. You know, and it was a good job, and yeah, he quit his job, and not to worry, things would be fine. And you know what, in the back of my head, I really knew that they would be, because I know that family would be okay. You know, the family would take care of whatever he didn't, probably, money-wise. And so a few weeks went by, and I didn't see much effort on his part to do any job search, but he was trying to be a farmer. He started growing pot in the backyard. And I mean, these plants were huge. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm just going to say this part really quick. I thought, well, I don't know. We'll tide us over. I don't know, you know. And so his mother came over one night to visit, and she had been at the hospital with his dad, who was in there very, very ill. And she came over, and one of my kids said, Grandma, you want to see the garden? You know, and I'm like, oh, my God. Well, he had those plants fenced off. There was a fence, so you couldn't really see the plants. You could see the garden. Well, for some reason, she walked around there and spied those, and they were huge. And she came in, and she ripped him a new one, I'm telling you, up one side and down the other. And she said if he did not get out there and pull those out of that ground, that she was going to call the police. Because now it was revealed to me that he'd been in trouble for stuff like that before. I didn't know it. You know? And so I'm like, okay. Well, she left, and he was out there, and that was the most pitiful sight I've ever seen in a man. It was kind of rainy. And he had one of those hats on. I don't know where he got it, but it had that light thing on top of it. And it was dark. And he was out there, and he was shoveling those plants out, just knocking them out of the ground. It was so funny because he was bawling like a baby. And there that went, you know. So he brought those in, and he hung them up in the garage upside down. They think he hanged them, or they would dry out. And still, he wasn't doing a lot of job searching. And that crop didn't seem to be too lucrative because he sold some of it to my brother and his friends, and they came and got it and put it in the back of a pickup and covered it up with a tarp and drove it back to Porterville. And I guess they tried some of it, and it wasn't any good. They brought it back and dumped it on our front porch. And, you know, my kids decided they would take some. And they would take it to the neighbors, and they would dry it out in the microwave. Now, mind you, these kids are 11 and 12. So, you know, they really knew a lot about it, I'm sure. Probably more than I think they did, but anyway, that caused trouble in the neighborhood and whatever, and I, you know, something just kind of snapped in me, and I thought, you know what, this is not working for me. I'm working two jobs, you have no job, you're growing pot, my kids are getting stoned, I gotta go. So I left. And, you know, this is another thing I do all the time, too. I cannot even let go of a bad relationship. I gotta leave claw marks on something, you know? You know, and it's just insane. So I thought, oh man. And then, you know, he moved out into the country on his parents' property and got this mobile home set up and everything. And I don't know how long went by. Enough time for a few of his friends to come knocking on my door, which thank God I was not insane enough to let him in. But that's the kind of people we hung out with, you know, his good buddies. That's the kind of people those people were, really. They were fun, loving, and all of that. They didn't have any morals, you know, and I don't know that I was too above them, to be honest. But anyway, he begged me to come back, and actually, that's not the truth of that story. During that time, I had, we were split up, I went back and had a little dating going on with one of the men that I dated before I met him. And, you know, as you can see from my story, I've had a lot of husbands. Most of them were mine. Not all of them. And this guy came back into my life, and boom, before I knew it, I was pregnant. And that was not good, because he and I had been trying to get pregnant, and he didn't have any kids. And I thought, oh, crap. And I certainly didn't want any more. So I went and had an abortion, and that night, my girlfriend that took me, we all went out to that crazy Delbert up there on Lovers, what is that movie? Yeah, we went out dancing, and there he was, and there dancing, and me too. You know, I wasn't feeling the greatest, but I was drinking, so I could feel pretty good. Didn't matter. They had given me probably something, and with the booze, that was okay. But we decided we would try it one more time and get back together, and so I said, okay. And then I moved out there with him, me and the girls. And then I came home one night after working at Vaughn's, and, you know, he still wasn't working. And he had dinner ready, and they were sitting around the dinner table. And I looked over, and Shelley's head was like this in the plate of spaghetti, down in it. And I'm like, whoa. And Lori said, she probably drank too much of that wine. He had let them drink wine. And I don't know, that really did it for me. So I left, and I got rid of him, and I said, I don't want nothing. Come in together that long, and all I want is a car that's paid for, because that's what I came with, and my own personal belongings, and I left. And went on another spree of doing really crazy things, drinking, partying, different people, whatever, bringing people home, never once caring, you guys, never once about my kids. You know, I never put them first. It was all about me. I was selfish. I was self-seeking. I was self-serving. And you know what? If I didn't get out of you what I wanted when I was done with you, I left. You know, I just was that kind of a person, and I never thought there was anything wrong with it. You know, and I come in here and I hear these stories about people that end up in jail and you know, have DUIs and all of these things. And, you know, I'm just going to tell you, I've had 4 DUIs. A divorce under the influence. I got married another time. You know? And I didn't wreck cars. I didn't have to go to jail. I didn't get sick. I wrecked people. I wrecked lives. And I tore things up from the inside out that are really hard to fix. The last marriage lasted not very long, but it took me 16 years to let go of that one from start to finish. And you know what? I drank for 30 years. I started when I was in my late 20s. I drank too much and too long, and I drank too much too long. So I'm not one of those people that my story isn't saying, oh, I hated coming here and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. There's part in the big book, and we read it every day when I went to rehab, and it said, I used to think that the worst thing that could happen to a girl like me would be that I would be an alcoholic. And today I know it's the best thing. You know, when I got here, I had to learn who I was. I had to find out who I was, and it started really by finding out who I didn't want to be. Because I was trying to be whoever anybody wanted me to be. I don't even really know what part of my life belonged to me. People pleasing and whatever you wanted, I would do. You know, I didn't ask questions. You know, if something was offered to me, I took it. You know, if something wasn't offered to me and I wanted it, I'd steal it. I used to sports steal. You know, I didn't need that stuff. I used to do it. It would be funny. And we'd go on vacations with groups of people, and we'd get in contests about who could steal things. You know? And you know what? That's really not funny, because you could get in trouble for that, you know? But like I said, I never got any consequences. I never got caught. You know? And that's what I think about, like, the DUIs, the real kind. There's no reason on God's earth that I didn't get one of those, because I drove around all the time drunk. I remember driving home from Cutler one night with my kids in the car, and they were scared to death. I was drunk. I drove my grandkids around drunk. I drove my mother around drunk. I mean, God, I just can't even believe that I've made it without some of those yets. And I'm going to tell you, it's because of God's grace and mercy only. Because I deserve them. You know, I thank God every day that I didn't get everything I deserved. Because if I did, if I had it, I wouldn't be here standing up here in front of you guys tonight. I'd be in jail, I'd be dead, or I'd be in hospital somewhere. You know, I chased fun. That was my thing. I had to have always fun. I never thought about anything being anything other than fun. And when it quit being fun, out the door I went. You know, and my last drunk wasn't my funnest. I know funnest isn't a word. I say funnest. I say was gonna. Was gonna's not a word. I say fuck it. I say, yeah, but, you know, I say all those things because that's how I used to live. I could justify every stinking thing I ever did in my life. If there was a job that you could get and you could be a justifier, I would be signed up. Because I could justify anything I did. No matter who it hurt, no matter what I did, no matter who suffered, I was never wrong. You know, and I'm like what they say in the book too, you know what? If everybody would just listen to me and do what I say, this world would be a much better place. Much better. And when I found out I wasn't the director, that was quite a blow. You know, because I didn't turn out to be anything like I planned on being. You know, and it kind of sucks to get up and find out you're not who you planned on being. You know, and that last drunk that wasn't the funnest started at 10:30 in the morning. That was another thing. In my job that I had, you know, I was always blessed with being able to make a living. And I changed careers when I was 42 years old. And that was during my time of 4 years of sobriety by just not drinking. That was a long 4 years. First year wasn't bad because I had been bet $1,000 that I couldn't do it. I couldn't stay without booze for a year, and I won the money. And then I stayed dry for three more. Bad 3 years. I still did the same things. I still went to the same places. All I did was not drink. That didn't work for me. Then about 10 years later after that, I tried doing it with religion. That didn't work for me. You know, and I am not a religious person. I don't believe in organized religion. But I am here to tell you that I have a big God today, and I have spirituality, and I have a daily, daily contact with a God that is huge. And I don't think he ever left me. I think he's always been with me. I know he has, you know. I just know he has. And I like to give the credit to him because I think anybody can quit drinking. I think anybody can stop. I just don't think everybody gets to get this gift of sobriety, you know. But it is something that we have to be willing to surrender to. And that's exactly what I did on April 16, 2008, was my first day sober. And I hear people say we should probably count it the day after because we probably had such a ripping headache that day. We probably really shouldn't count that, but we do. So April 16, 2008, I got up. I felt like crap. I got on the internet, and I found a rehab to go to. Now, still, you know, I'm managing well. I live in a nice house. I drive a nice car. I have money in the bank. I have a great job. And I didn't lose a lot of things like that. But what I'd lost was my soul. I had spiritual bankruptcy, like the book says. And I had kicked that to the curb, you know, along with everybody else that I ever came across that I thought less of than I did myself. And, you know, I found a place in Laguna Beach. It looked pretty good on the internet, you know, and I couldn't get in there for a week. And they told me if I came in 7 days sober, I wouldn't have to go to detox. And I said, okay. And he goes, if you have to go to detox, it's going to be $1,000 more. And I said, okay, you know. And, well, I really didn't know what detox was, but I'm thinking I'm not paying another $1,000, so I just won't drink till I go. Or, you know, I'll go, today is just it. I'm not drinking anymore. Well, I went on a Tuesday, and on Sunday night prior to that, my neighbors, who were my drinking buddies, had me over for dinner. And they were drinking, and they said, does this bother you? And I said, no, it doesn't. And in my head, it started going, 72 hours. Sunday. How many just 72 hours till Tuesday? Maybe I can have one more last wing, because I didn't plan that last one. But you know, I couldn't do the math, and I didn't do it. So I went, and my friends drove me down there, and when we got there, we drove up, and she said, this probably isn't it. This is probably just where you do the paperwork. and then you go to the nice place, like on the picture. And I said, well, I don't know. And you know what? It didn't look like the picture, but it did the trick. And it was a very humbling experience. There was only about 8 people in there. I was the oldest person, of course. And I believe that God has already started being funny with me, because all of them were young. And they got on my last nerve. They were not serious about their recovery, and I was. You know, and I blew up on them about the third day, and I said, listen, I don't have another recovery in me. I don't have mommy and daddy paying for this, and I got to get sober. It was very quiet around there for about 2 days. They laid the foundation for Alcoholics Anonymous is what they did. You know, they gave us big books. We had meditation every morning. We had groups. They took us to meetings. And when you go to meetings down in Orange County, they're a little bit different than they are here. And I won't say they're better. They're just different. And talk about humiliating. You know, not only do you have to stand up and say, hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. In the first 30 days of sobriety, you know, gotta do it again because you're a visitor. You know, and you've already arrived in that white bus, you know. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh. But you know what? I got used to saying that, and I didn't mind the ring it had to it, because at least I knew what I was. And our weekends down there, we had a weekend babysitter. And this was a kind of a funny part of my story. The weekend babysitter would come on Friday evenings, and he would stay till Sunday, and he would stay till Monday morning, and take us to meetings and all the things that we did on the weekends. And we had Joey Buttafuoco for our weekend babysitter. I don't know if y'all know who that is, but crazy, crazy man. You know, he was so... I wouldn't have known who that was had they not said. But anyway, he was soft, he was sweet, he was gentle, you know, he was a really nice person. Until the last weekend before the Tuesday I was supposed to go home. No, there were 2 weeks in the weekend before the weekend I was supposed to go home. I heard this ruckus downstairs, down below the rehab, and it was him, and he was down there, and he was just beating the hell out of these people, these 2 junkies that were trying to steal his stuff off his motorcycle. And I was peeking down the stair thing, and I was looking, I was scared, and he took one of their cell phones, and he threw it up against the cement wall, and it just busted. And, you know, he was in a rage like I've never seen, and I didn't know what to do. There was nobody there but him, and us alcoholics, you know, so I had no protection. Anyway, he wanted us to lie about what we saw, and I told him no, that I wouldn't lie about that. I said, I won't go down there, and I won't get in the face of the cops, and I won't tell them unless they come and they ask me, and then I'm going to tell them what I saw. Well, he didn't come back. They didn't bring him back. I had another man, and he was a very nice man, too. He was a professional interventionist, and he got paid $1,000 a day to watch movie stars to keep them away from harming themselves. I mean, that's where it takes some of us, you know. And that was an experience, you know, and I just am thankful that I did get to go do that, you know, because for me, I learned that... I think I did all my relapsing before I got here. Tried 3 times not to drink and all that stuff. And every time I'd go back, I would get worse. It's just like the book says, it always gets worse. It never gets better. It quits working for me. And I can't ever get back that fun and that way it was when I started, you know, because things change. I change. You know, and they used to say, once a pickle, never back a cucumber. You know, and I thought, well, that's weird, but it's true. Once a pickle, never a cucumber again. You know, we are what we are, and we have to own it, you know. And I'm still trying to read something that I wrote because I can't read, so I'm putting these on. Okay. I know that today, you know what, I am nothing without God in my life. And what he gives me is a daily reprieve. And it's not about just drinking. It's about up here. You know, if I do what I'm supposed to do, and I really have a conscious contact with him, he gives me peace and serenity. And I'm not used to that. I'm getting used to it, and I like it. But in the beginning, I felt kind of worthless and like I wasn't doing enough. Because I used to be a human doing, not a human being. Today, I can sit still, I can enjoy that peace and serenity, and I can get grateful, you know, and be happy. Because when I come here to these rooms, you guys give me hope. You know, you always did. From the very beginning, and I felt welcome, and then I felt loved. And you guys could love me when I couldn't love myself. And, you know, it's funny because people, we don't always, it's like those mirrors that say things may appear larger than they are. I should have had that right on my head because that's how my life appears, larger than it was. Because I looked kind of like the speaker said it's Sunday about when you see a swan on a lake, and you know, they're just gliding along so smooth. If you looked underneath the water, you would see those feet going like this, you know. And that's kind of how I feel some days, you know. And then he also had a good one. He said, you know what, God will steer, but he won't row. And I like that one, too. I have to remember to keep both oars in the water. You know, one comes out, and I'm just spinning in a circle again, you know. And I don't know. It's a thing of surrender for me, and it's a thing of staying willing. And it's about people. And, you know, I was a fun chaser. I'm still chasing it. I chase it in AA. I hang out with wonderful people, people that are so much fun, and people that have shown me how to live without drinking, you know, without even wanting to. You know, I never do I wake up in the morning and forget that I'm an alcoholic. And I never wake up in the morning and forget that I don't need to pray. Nothing I'm doing. The only thing I'm doing perfectly here is not drinking. And I pray that I'll stay, because it doesn't matter how we get here or when we get here. It matters that we stay. And it's by God's grace that all of us are here, and there's a bunch of miracles here in this room. So if you're new, stay. You know, keep coming back. George Wellingman, when he took his 50-year tip, he said, here's what I'm going to say to people that are new. Don't drink. Go to lots of meetings and stay stupid. And then I thought, I could do that. You know, because I'm one of those people that when I start thinking that I know everything, then I find out just how much I don't know. But today I do know that I have a lot to be grateful for and thankful for. And God bless you all for being here and for listening to me. Thanks.